So I'm speaking this morning about choice and justice, and I'm going to pull a little bit from a sermon I preached here last February on healthy sexuality, but I'm going to do actually the same quote from that. Some of you may or may not remember it, but it's one of my favorites, and so I think it's worth sharing again as our reading. It comes from a guy named Butch Hancock, who was a country singer coming out of Texas. Still is, actually. But he helped launch the progressive country movement. And so this is what he writes. "Life in Lubbock, Texas, taught me two things. One is that God loves you, and you're going to burn in hell. The other is that sex is the most awful, filthy thing on earth, and you should save it for someone you love." It's honestly hard for me to imagine someone more concisely or humorously capturing our society's relationship with religion and sexuality and the fact that those two are deeply related. That on both, we have this spectrum from brokenness and fear and shame and damnation to this beautiful vision of love and connection and acceptance and wholeness. And that all we do in this country is between those two polarities. And what I'm going to talk about today is how we negotiate that path and what I think has been working and hasn't been working about our role as religious people in the struggle for justice. And I do so in part because this year, 2013, is the 40th anniversary of the Roe versus Wade decision. It's also the 40th anniversary of the organization I work for, the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. So it is an important year to be reflecting on where we've come and where we're going. And I'm going to do something a little different than I tend to do in sermons this morning, which is to tell a little bit more of my personal story to you. You've gotten to know me, many of you have gotten to know me throughout this time, but there's a lot that I haven't said, and I tend not to talk about myself a lot, so I'm going to give that a shot today, and I hope it's interesting and meaningful to you, and that you find some of yourself in my story as well. So folks often ask, how did I, a guy, get involved in this work for reproductive choice and reproductive justice? And the answer is I learned it from my daddy. That growing up, my father, who's a Unitarian Universalist, both my parents raised me in a UU church. And my father identified, from as early as I can remember, as a very strong feminist. And he used to escort at the local abortion clinic. And I did that with him a few times in high school. And just always knew that women were equal. And even before I understood sort of why that was true, I remember arguments with friends about that. Now, at the same time, I was kind of a jockey, not entirely self-aware kid, you know, who lived in the white suburbs and went to a mostly white school in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and still had some of the same ideas about things as many of my peers. But that changed one day in youth group. It was about ninth grade, and our teachers weren't there yet for this morning. And ninth grade is kind of the first year that you can be in the youth group in most congregations. And I knew some of the older kids and looked up to them. And I also liked attention, frankly. And so as we were waiting for class to begin, I decided to tell a joke. And I thought it was one of my better jokes. And it was also a joke that made fun of gay and lesbian people. And after I told it, there was complete silence in the room. I recognized this as a bad sign. And one of the older women in the group, who had been in the church for a very long time, said to me, "Why do you think that's funny?" And she wasn't angry. She just said it matter-of-factly. Why do you think that's funny? And I had the good sense not to say what I thought, which was, because gay people are funny? Oh. And that single question started a process in my brain of asking a lot more questions about people who are different than me and why they had rights or didn't, why they deserved equal treatment or not. And it actually led me to want to go into justice work. And I was supported in that by my youth group and by my church all through high school. I went to the March for Women's Lives in Washington, D.C. in 1992, and as a 14-year-old boy, joined the National Organization for Women. They had really good bumper stickers. I went to the LGBT March in 1993 and came back and wrote a letter to the editor on gay pride for the local paper. And as I went through high school, I studied politics more and more. And I went to college for politics. And I decided that the best possible way for me to make a change was to make it on the biggest scale possible. I was going to work for the United Nations. You know, because what's a bigger way to make a difference than the United Nations? And so I studied abroad in Geneva, Switzerland, so I could study the UN. But a funny thing happened there. Our class visited a series of different non-governmental and governmental organizations. And one of them was a place called the South Center, which was an organization representing nations from the global South, less developed countries. And the executive director of that group spent his hour with us essentially railing against U.S. foreign policy and all the damage that it had done and was still doing around the world. And he concluded by saying, "We don't need any more Americans in the United Nations. Fix your own darn country." He didn't say darn at that time, though. And for me, it was another of those giant worldview-shifting moments when I realized that my work wasn't somewhere else in the UN fixing problems that were elsewhere. My work was in this country. And as I thought about my place in the work, what I kept coming back to is where I started and learned about justice work, which was my faith. And I felt like my place in the movement, where I could make the most difference, was to do faith-based work for justice in this country. And funny thing, as I got more and more into that and trying to hone sort of what's my niche, what's my faith-based justice niche, what I came back to was exactly the set of issues that opened my eyes in the first place, which is that connection of issues around faith and sexuality. And what I've come to believe very strongly is that religion has done a disproportionate amount of the damage in this country to healthy sexuality. And so from my perspective, we have a disproportionate role to play in the healing. And in fact, we have to be involved in the struggle, because the people who oppose reproductive health and rights and justice and LGBT equality do so always, if not directly, then at least indirectly, from a faith perspective. And so it makes an enormous difference what we do or don't do as religious people on these issues. Okay, so I've said a few times the words reproductive health and rights and justice, and I want to unpack that last phrase for you, reproductive justice. So that phrase is not just a combination of words that means kind of the same thing as reproductive choice, but is with a different language. It's actually a very distinct approach to these issues, and it's an approach that I think brings together a lot of pieces that many of us and the Unitarian Universalist Association has been working for and striving for many years. And so I want to tell you a little bit more about that and then say why it matters to us here in these walls as well as out of these walls. So reproductive justice is a frame that was developed in 1994 by a group of women of color who felt left out by the existing reproductive choice movement. And what they felt is that the reproductive choice movement really focused on an individual legal right to abortion, and that it was a legal right that was kind of guaranteed through the privacy protections of the Constitution. And what they believed is that there's a very big difference between having the legal right to something and having actual access to it. And that for them, their lived experience of women of color was not that their community needed primarily access to abortion, although they did and do. But they needed access to health care. And that for them, it's not just about not being a parent, it's also the right to parent and the right to raise children in a safe environment. And so they created this frame that pairs reproductive rights with social justice. And there are four pillars of reproductive justice now. It is the right to have the children we want, the right to not have children if we don't want them or we don't want more children, the right to parent children in a safe and healthy environment, and the right to be free of reproductive and sexual oppression, the right to make decisions about our own bodies and our own lives. And so this 40th anniversary of Roe v. Wade is important to note for what the Roe decision has done for women and for families in this country in terms of giving access to abortion in a way that didn't exist before that. But it's only a small piece of this struggle. And I want to share a story from my work about that. So I travel for the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice a fair amount. And as you can imagine, telling strangers that I meet exactly what I do is sometimes a little tricky. And there are times when I'm tired, you know, and I'm on an airplane or in a, you know, Amtrak waiting room or somewhere, and I just don't want to get into a conversation about abortion rights or when life begins or religion. But on one night, I found myself in a small town bar in Western Maryland. I was watching a Steelers game. There's only a few people there, and the bartender, who is a woman about my age, comes over and, you know, says, "What brings you to town?" And I say, "I'm coming back from a business trip in Ohio." And she says, "Oh, what do you do?" "Well, I'm a minister who works on faith-based advocacy for reproductive health rights and justice." Long pause. But after a pause, and you could see that she was thinking, this made me nervous. I'm not sure what's going to come out. But what she said, the first words out of her mouth were, "Thank you." She said, "Thank you for doing that work. You know, I got pregnant in high school, and my Catholic stepfather wouldn't let me get an abortion. He would have kicked me out of the house. You know, I had wanted to go to college, but here I am working in this bar. I have two kids, and I love them. But I had a different future in mind, and I'm really working hard now to make sure that my kids get a good sex education, because I didn't. And I don't want them to be faced with the same situation I was." Now you see, the Roe v. Wade decision didn't help her at all, because she didn't get a quality sex education at school. She didn't have access to the information and resources she needed. And when it came time for her to want to end her pregnancy, She was unable to do so for barriers that had nothing to do with legal rights. They had to do with our culture and whether or not people get to make decisions about what happens to their own bodies and their own lives. And so I know that for many of us, and for many of you, especially women who have worked for reproductive choice for a long time, you have a lot of connection with that word and that work, and I applaud you for what you have done. And I was there also, but I feel like what I've learned since is that reproductive choice was only a part of the elephant. And that what this reproductive justice approach offers is a bigger picture and a bigger story of what's really happening and what we need to do about it. That it's not just about avoiding pregnancy. It's also about helping people to have the pregnancies they want and have health care for it, for people to make their own decisions. And so here's what's happening in the world today on these issues, because it's not all bad news. The very good news is that the teen birth rate in this country is the lowest it's ever been. The bad news of that is that it's still the highest teen birth rate in the developed world. It's progress, but we still have a long way to go. Access to contraception has increased dramatically, thanks in part to Obamacare. But as I'm sure you know, it has also brought out of the woodwork an enormously vocal group of religious people who still believe that birth control is morally evil. We've made great progress on LGBT marriage equality, and yet we still have a long way to go to make sure that every LGBT person has the right not to be fired from their job and has access to the federal benefits of marriage. And although we've seen younger generations having very different ideas about sexuality and LGBT equality, the same is not true for their views on access to abortion. And the reality is that in the last 11 years, actual access to abortion in this country has decreased dramatically, because law after law has been passed that just chips away at Roe, waiting periods, mandatory ultrasounds, mandatory information that's given. So much so that in the last 5 years alone, states have passed over 200 restrictions on access to abortion. 200. And just last week, I had the pleasure, using the word pleasure very loosely, of being in a hearing in the U.S. House of Representatives building on a bill that would ban abortion nationwide after 20 weeks. And in this year, 2013, not a single supporter of that legislation mentioned the circumstances that a woman or family was in that might lead them to want an abortion. Not a single mention of a woman or a family. It was all about that potential life and the rights it should have. And notably, no one mentioned what rights or resources a child might need after birth, or who would provide them. It was absolute grandstanding for telling women what they can do with their bodies in 2013. And so, yes, we as religious people have an important role to play. And there's one last piece of this reproductive justice framework that I want to share, which is that reproductive justice is not just an agenda that is broader. It is also a different way of doing the work. And it's a way that calls us to take leadership and to bring into leadership the people that are most affected by the issue. Women of color, women struggling in poverty, immigrants, LGBT people, transgender people, the folks that have their lives affected literally daily by the lack of access to health care and to legal rights. Because reproductive justice isn't just about policy change, it's about changing power. It's about changing who's in power, who has power, and why. And now it may seem like this struggle is mostly about issues or dynamics that happen outside the walls of this congregation. But if I've learned anything in this work, it's that our society's brokenness on sexual and reproductive health affects every single person, every single one of us. Because shame and fear and judgment are incredibly powerful forces. And without a proactive vision, without a positive vision to move us forward, I think we can't avoid these obstacles to our joy and our health and our wholeness. And so what we face in this polarity is on one side this incredible moralism, this fear and this shame and this judgment. And the theological approach that controls people is really based on a theme or a regime of regulation and judgment and punishment. That there's one way to be in this world, that if you violate that, you are a sinner, you are immoral, and that you deserve to be punished for it. You deserve to be outcast. You deserve not to have access to decisions about your own body. But what we have to offer, and I don't think we talk about this nearly enough, is a powerful theological vision that can move us forward. It's a theology of pluralism that respects each person's right to hold a different view. Because, hey, that's what our Constitution says, that we get to hold different views. That's what democracy is. The government's role is not to pick one religious perspective, but to respect each person's ability to make decisions according to their own beliefs. Our theology is a theology of love that says that all people have value. All people should get to make decisions about what happens to their bodies. Our theology says that knowledge is good. And friends, that is different from what a lot of other folks believe. That access to accurate information is a battle that happens in many congregations and in many legislatures all across this country. And I am proud to be part of a Unitarian Universalist tradition that was distinguished from others by our openness to information and truth and new ideas. And that still distinguishes us today from other perspectives in this country. And finally, we believe that sexuality is good. Sexuality is a gift from God, from our Creator, that we can use to bring more love and more joy and more connection into this world. And so, friends, I ask you, what would it look like for you to love yourself more in this respect? What would it look like for you to work through any failings of shame or of self-judgment that you have about your own body and your own sexuality? What would it look like for you to open up a little bit more? And likewise, what about your attitudes towards others, and especially those in our society with the least access to information and to healthcare? Are your opinions about those communities guided more by a theology of judgment, which is how we are all raised, or theology of compassion and respect? And how, if at all, would you like to act differently towards other groups and other communities in the future? My sense is that shame begets shame, that judgment begets judgment, even if we're directing that shame and judgment against others, I think we are also doing it to ourselves. But fortunately, thankfully, we have a powerful theology and a powerful vision that shows us a way forward. Working for reproductive justice, grounded in our religious calling to love, to liberation, provides us with a perfect opportunity, an amazing opportunity, to take our strong legacy of work for reproductive choice, for gender equality, for LGBT equality, and transform it into what our nation deeply needs right now, which is more people, and especially more people of faith, who are willing to step up and create a culture where all people have the rights, the respect, and the resources they deserve. So may it be. Amen.